This podcast was produced from a webinar. For a more interactive experience with visuals, visit myamericannurse.com/webinars.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Tammy Merrill. I am the Senior Clinical Consultant specializing in temperature management.
And hi, everyone. My name is Hannah Fox, and I am our marketing lead for our temperature management products, which include Alteryx and Mistral Air.
We are so excited to be with you today and looking forward to discussing the latest on temperature management guidelines as it relates to the recently released American Heart Association Advisory Statement, as well as the importance of maintaining normal thermia in the OR. So let's get into it. Ever since the 2013 study, the first since the original temperature management studies, the TM world has been in turmoil. Our professional organizations and the American Heart Association haven't given clear guidance on how to interpret the findings and put them into practice. This has led to a lot of confusion in TTM practice regarding what the best approach should be. We are here today to provide some clarity. The American Heart Association has published an advisory statement ahead of the guidelines coming out later this year regarding post-cardiac arrest care. This statement is in response to the latest TTM study, commonly known as TTM-2. TTM-2 compared mild hypothermia to normal thermia in out-of-hospital cardiac arrests of cardiac or unknown cause in patients with shockable rhythms. They concluded that there was no difference between the two groups in mortality or severe disability. The AHA advisory states that in cardiac arrest patients similar to those in the TTM-2 study, preventing fever or maintaining normal thermia is reasonable and evidence-based. They go on to say that in cardiac arrest patients other than those in the TTM-2 trial, non-cardiac cause with non-shockable rhythm, the ideal approach to TTM is less certain, and that some of these patients may benefit from temperature controls determined at provider's discretion. They were also very clear that 46% of the normothermia group required a temperature management device, highlighting the need for active measures to prevent fevers.
Thank you for diving into that, Tammy. So now let's talk about the elephant in the room. Do we still need a TTM device? The answer is yes. The AHA Advisory Committee concluded that fever prevention is reasonable in a certain subset of patients, but that some patients may benefit from temperature controls determined at a provider's discretion. And remember, 46% of the normal thermia patients in the study needed active measures to prevent fever, so still required a precision temperature management device. Alteryx is Stryker's precision temperature management device that provides rapid cooling and rate-controlled warming to cover all of your therapy needs, from low to high acuity. In times when precision matters most, you can count on Alteryx. It is simple, safe, and efficient. In high acuity situations, simplicity is key for the caregiver. Alteryx is not only very straightforward to set up, but also offers simple, quickly initiated therapy through its guided touchscreen navigation. This limits the cognitive overload on the caregiver and delivers critical therapy when needed most. Once selecting automatic mode, you follow just two steps to start therapy. Step one, select your target temperature. There are three presets, 33, 36, or 37, to quickly select or up and down arrows to go anywhere in between. Step two is how quickly do you want to get there? We most often see max mode selected. Hit confirm and you are off and running. In moments when patient safety is critical, Alteryx delivers with its market-leading precision within plus or minus 0.1 degrees Celsius. This is achieved through the device's ability to read a patient's temperature every 1.3 seconds and adjust every 2.6 seconds. Additionally, our blue Alteryx wraps support patient's skin integrity with their non-adhesive design and easy-to-clean surface. The three-layer construction provides additional insulation and improved thermal transfer. You can count on Alteryx to provide safe therapy when needed most. The cherry on top is the efficiency Alteryx brings for all involved. There is an external translucent water reservoir for easy water management. All hoses are individually monitored. There are also visual indicators to quickly be able to assess therapy status from afar or at a quick glance. And if at any point you have questions, the situational help feature is there to provide assistance at any time. Not only can we use Alteryx in a high acuity setting, Alteryx is also completely safe for use in the OR. We have worked with the FDA to validate our disinfection process and prove that we do not aerosolize microbes out of the water source.
We've been focusing on critical care temperature management, but what about in the OR? We know that normal thermia in the periop environment is important for our patients. Let's talk a little more about that. We will define normal thermia and hypothermia. We'll identify the causes and symptoms of hypothermia. We'll identify specific populations that are at risk of becoming hypothermic and talk about how technology can help us. So what defines normal? Well, normal core temperature is 37 degrees Celsius. Hypothermia is defined as core temperature less than 36 degrees, and hyperthermia is core temperature above normal, knowing that serious injury can happen if the patient goes above 40 degrees. Let's talk very briefly about hyperthermia. So again, hyperthermia is core temperature above normal, knowing that it can be a medical emergency if the patient goes above 40 degrees Celsius. When we talk about temperatures above normal, we generally speak about fever. Well, there is a difference between fever and hyperthermia. Fever is a temp above normal due to inflammatory or infectious causes. The hypothalamic set point is changed and your thermal regulatory response is intact. So fevers will respond to your NSAIDs. Hyperthermia, on the other hand, while it is a temp above normal, is due to pathological, environmental, or drug-related causes. Your hypothalamic set point is not changed, but your thermal regulatory response is impaired, so hyperthermia will not respond to NSAIDs. Malignant hyperthermia is something that occurs most commonly in the OR. It is a potentially fatal condition which core temperature may rise over 40 degrees, usually following exposure to anesthetics. It is always a medical emergency. Standard of care is to give dantrolene immediately and follow your hospital malignant hyperthermia protocol. Now let's switch gears to hypothermia. There are three levels of hypothermia: mild, moderate, and deep or severe. Mild hypothermia is defined as temperatures between 32 or 33 up to 36. Moderate is 28 to 32 or 33, and then deep or severe is less than 28. Some of the symptoms of mild hypothermia are shivering, dizziness, hunger, but also nausea, increased heart rate, increased breathing, trouble speaking, confusion, lack of coordination. These are all attempts of your body to increase your temperature. As you slip further into moderate or severe hypothermia, your shivering will cease, clumsiness gets worse, speech becomes more impaired, become more confused, more drowsy, lack of concern for your own condition. You can progress into loss of consciousness, weak pulse, and slow, shallow breathing. There are special populations that are at higher risk for becoming hypothermic: age-related, like the elderly, children, or neonates, and patients in the OR. As we get older, we lose the ability to regulate our own temperature due to changes in the central nervous system and the structure of the skin. Elderly patients are more likely to have other medical conditions that can affect their thermal regulation as well, such as hypothyroidism, severe arthritis, or diseases that affect circulation like diabetes. Some patients can even become hypothermic just due to low household temperatures. Children have a greater surface area to mass ratio, which leads to increased heat loss in extreme cold. They also lack the proper judgment to wear the correct clothing or come in out of the cold. Neonates are special in that they require a neutral thermal environment. They have little to no shiver mechanism. Exposure to cold leads to norepinephrine release, which can break down the brown fat that they need for survival. They are at risk for cold stress, where they are losing more heat than they can generate. Now let's talk about our OR patients. The average patient experiences a 0.5 to 1.5 degree decrease in core temperature in the first hour of the procedure. Research has shown that up to 20% of patients experience unintended hypothermia. This is due to multiple factors: contact with the cold surface, exposure to the cold temperatures in the room, and alteration in thermal regulation mechanisms due to anesthesia. Cold-induced vasoconstriction is inhibited by the anesthesia. Some of the complications of hypothermia in the OR patient include increased perioperative blood loss, platelet dysfunction, and need for transfusions. Some research has shown up to 20% increase in a need for transfusion in an hypothermic patient. Hypothermic patients are also 3 times more likely to experience a cardiac event, such as arrhythmias or ischemia. They're also 3 times more likely to experience a surgical site infection. There's an increased peripheral vascular resistance, as well as decreased drug metabolism and impaired renal function. It is very important to pre-warm our patients. AORN and other professional organizations have stated that we should pre-warm a minimum of 30 minutes before surgery. This allows the periphery to vasodilate and may prevent the redistribution of thermal energy in the OR. Warming techniques maintain intra-op temps when patients are already vasodilated. If not pre-warmed, intra-op warming is ineffective in preventing the initial fall in temperature. There's been a lot of discussion around cotton blankets versus forced air warming devices. Research favors the forced air warming over cotton blankets. One layer of cotton blankets decreases heat loss by about 30%, and additional layers did not help. Forced air warming blankets achieve normothermia faster than with cotton blankets. Patients warmed actively with forced air warming achieved higher temperatures than those warmed passively, like with cotton blankets. Warm blankets decrease heat loss better than unwarm blankets, but the benefit dissipates in about 10 minutes. Hypothermia can affect surgical site infections as well. Hypothermia impairs neutrophil function, triggers subcutaneous vasoconstriction, and results in tissue hypoxia. There was some earlier research that implied that forced air warming caused surgical site infection. This research used blankets that either were specifically named as bear hugger or stated that they were perforated blanket systems. Recent research has shown that the downward laminar flow in the OR counteracted the airflow from the blanket.
Now that we understand the importance of maintaining normal thermia in the OR, let's talk about achieving normal thermia in the OR with Mistral Air. Mistral Air is Stryker's forced air warming system. Mistral Air embodies 3 exclusive features that provide simple, safe, and efficient care: HEPA filtration, diffusion technology, and reflective technology. Our HEPA filter is 99.99% effective in capturing what is considered to be the most difficult particle size to capture, surpassing the level of filtration required for protective clinical environments like the operating room and isolation rooms. Our diffusion technology reduces floating and lofting and minimizes airflow disruption. This leads to improved patient comfort and overall linen reduction. We see linen use reduced by an average of 86%. Our reflective technology holds up to 80% more heat and allows for passive warming during patient transfer. We offer a variety of different blanket types and sizes, including reflective, sterile, and premium.
Wow, we've covered a lot of information today.
We really have, and hopefully you all had some great takeaways to bring back to the clinical setting.
I'm sure there are some questions or clarifications that are needed. We're taking questions live or in the chat.
Thank you, Tammy and Hannah. Hello, everyone. My name is Julie Cullen. I'm the managing editor of American Nurse Journal, and I'll be moderating the Q&A today. Before we get started, I did want to point out to you the resources available there for download. They're there on the left-hand side of your console. The other thing I also want to remind you about is that this webinar will be available on demand at myamericannurse.com/webinars shortly after we wrap up today. You'll also receive a link in your email that will take you directly to the webinar. When you registered for this webinar, we asked you to share your thoughts, your concerns, your questions about temperature management. Tammy and Hannah have given us a great overview to get us started, but we really want today's presentation to focus on what will help you provide the best patient care. To that end, the bulk of our time today will be devoted to answering your questions. Other questions that may have occurred to you during the presentation, so we encourage you to post those in the Q&A box in the console there that you see in front of you. You can also send them by email to webinars@healthcommedia.com, and we'll try to answer as many as possible in the time we have remaining today. So let's get started. We're going to start with the first question we have here, which is, what is the best universal method of managing temperature after Roski?
So there really isn't a universal method, but when you look at the research, most if not all of the researchers agree that using a precision device is best rather than some of the other like more manual methods like ice or ice saline, those kind of things.
Thank you. Here's another question for you, Tammy. Does lowering the TTM make a difference neurologically?
Yes. So lowering temp decreases the metabolic needs of the brain and reduces the incidence of cerebral edema and inflammation. While the most recent research only focused on death and severe disability, there has been some research that states that different temperatures can make a difference in the higher neurological function categories.
Okay. This question just actually came in from the audience just now. What was shown in the presentation seemed very adult-focused in terms of devices and disposables. Do you have pediatric-sized items, pads, for example, pads and blankets?
Yeah, I'm happy to take that one. We do offer some pediatric options here. We have a pediatric blanket specifically, and we've seen customers get really creative with how they maybe fold it or rolled certain towels or different things underneath it to use it in that space. But additionally, we also have our Alteryx Blue Wraps that you guys saw in the webinar. And we've seen customers get really creative with those too. So we have options out there that are definitely available, and we can work with customers on a case-by-case basis to figure out what works best for them.
Thanks, Hannah. Tammy, for you, how long to monitor after warming? What frequency? And also this question is asking about education for staff if hypothermia is identified.
Yeah. So this is another one of the pieces of TTM that is still a little bit unknown, the optimal time to monitor or control fever. A lot of the studies say at least 24 hours. Many of them point to more like 48 to 72, which is what I'm seeing more in the field as well. The frequency would depend on whatever device or would depend on the unit the patient is on. So in an ICU, you know, we would continue to do it every hour, every 2 hours, or if they still have their core probe in, we could just continue to do that. If we're 48 hours out, they're doing fine, they move to like a step down, you might be doing Q2 for a little while and then Q4. So it just kind of depends on what they're doing. As far as education for the staff for hypothermia, what really works the best, what I've seen work the best, is to leave them on whatever device you're using for at least 24 to 48 hours so that you can better control that and not let them go hypothermic again. But if they become hypothermic, we should just warm them back up to normal. And if you have them on the device, then they're less likely to do that.
Great. I have a couple more questions from the audience that just came through. I am seeing a trend with pediatric cardiac ICU patients and providers trying to use targeted temperature management to decrease metabolic demand on the body. Is there some evidence you've seen addressing this application in patient population?
I'll be honest, no, I haven't really seen much evidence. I haven't really looked into it. I do tend to play with adults more than pediatric patients, but it makes sense. I can see why they're trying to do it. That's what targeted temperature management does, is decrease metabolic demand. So it completely makes sense. And we do see TTM in pediatric populations as well as the neonatal populations as well.
Okay. How does the clinical team make a decision on target temp 36 versus 33?
This is going to have to be a kind of a multi-pronged approach, I think. A lot of discussion with the care team regarding the patient's comorbidities. Why did they arrest in the first place? You know, is it cardiac versus non-cardiac? Was it shockable, non-shockable? All those decisions. What was their downtime? All those. There's a lot of things that are going to go into it. I foresee, and I have seen some, but I foresee kind of algorithm type decision-making trees on if this, then this, then this, then okay, use that. So that's kind of what I'm seeing is going to happen. So there's going to have to be discussion.
Okay. Do the coding pads come in more than one size? Hannah, can you answer that question?
Yeah, absolutely. So for our cooling pads specifically, that's making me think of like the green blankets. Those come in an adult size and a pediatric size. But then additionally, we have our blue Altrix wraps that you all saw, and those come in two sizes. We have a small, medium, and then a large. Between those two sizes, they fit about 99% of the patient population. So super easy to figure out just having two sizes, and generally can make something work between those options.
Another question for you, Hannah. How to warm patients during total joint arthroplasty. Sorry about that. Current recommendation is to not use the blower type devices.
Yeah, this is a good one. And ultimately, it's really going to depend on the device that you're using. So our device specifically has a HEPA filter as well as the diffusion technology to minimize airflow. So it's a safe option for use in the OR. But that being said, many of the orthodoctors prefer a water-based device like Altrix that we saw over a forced air device.
Thank you. Why is temperature management important? What outcome can benefit the patient if we initiated temperature management?
Well, the whole reason for controlling temperature relates to decreasing metabolic and oxygen demands or needs in the brain to reduce that edema and inflammation, which then will reduce any cerebral ischemia and cell death. As far as that part of it, as far as normal thermia in the OR, keeping your patients warm is going to help reduce the risk of your SSIs, reduce the risk of untoward bleeding or too much bleeding, cardiac events, all those kind of things. So keeping them warm in surgery is very important, and then controlling their temperature for other uses, TTM, will help decrease metabolic and oxygen demands.
Another question from the audience. What is your recommendation on those patients who come in at 33, but the MD wants TTM at 36?
If they truly feel that 36 is the right temperature, then they need to warm them up. But if you are coming up from 33, I would recommend doing it slowly. Warming from hypothermia is always done at a slow rate. Again, don't know the perfect rate for that, but the literature supports no more than half a degree an hour. So it'll take you some time to get back up, but that would be the safest way.
Okay. Any special considerations for bariatric patients?
Really, for the bariatric patients, you just want to make sure that you are still covering as much body surface area as you can. As Hannah said, we do have the two sizes in our wraps, and the large size, we state the fit in kilograms, even though it's actually more of a estimate of girth. But so in kilograms, around 159 kilograms should still fit in our torso wraps. But again, if they weigh more than that and it fits, it's fine. It's really all about body surface area.
Are you aware of any literature that provides guidance on frequency of temperature monitoring for a patient in a med-surg unit who is being warmed with a forced air warming device?
Really, unfortunately, no. A lot of the literature to date still says that if they are cool enough that you feel like you need to use a forced air warming device, they should probably move up to a higher level of care. That being said, I know that there are med-surg units that are comfortable using the forced air warming device. My understanding is that they treat it kind of like a post-procedure, if you will. So Q1 times two, Q2 times two, Q4, whatever, you know, once they get to their goal, then, you can, in their maintenance, you can go down to like Q4 again. But it would depend on the unit itself and how comfortable their nurses are with that scenario.
Okay. Would it be appropriate to allow passive warming versus active warming if the patient started hypothermic and the goal is 36? Is there a preference?
I would say it would be much safer to stick with active warming. If you let them passively warm, they could most definitely warm too fast. And then you could get into trouble with that.
Okay. Can you highlight some expectations of temperature management if the patient must be transferred from one facility to another?
It depends on where in the process you are and how long that transfer is going to take. If the patient is already at goal, you should do whatever you can to keep them there. If you can, leave the disposables in place. In the case of ours, I would ensure that there was cool water in the wrap and then, leave the wrap on the patient and transfer. Again, it's going to depend on how long that transfer is going to take. If you're just starting and you haven't really started the process, then I would probably transfer first and have the other facility do the TTM, get started there.
Okay. What are the current recommendations for general use in drowning patients?
Ooh, that's a good one. I'll be honest, I have not looked at a lot of this, but it would depend on if they drowned in cold water or warm water. Did they arrest after the drowning? If so, then the post-ROSC protocol should be followed. Since it's not cardiac cause, normal thermia is probably not going to be the best approach. Choosing a different temperature might be better. But yeah, it would depend, I would think.
Can you talk about managing temperature caused by neurological damage, like from a head injury?
Yes, the research on that really suggests that preventing fevers appropriately is appropriate. Sorry, a little tongue-tied this morning. That just preventing fever, as we know in neurosurgical patients, fever is considered a secondary injury, so it's paramount to make sure that they don't get above normal. Generally, protocols are to maintain that normal thermia or control that fever for longer periods of time, like 7 to 10 days, but it would depend on the patient and how they're doing. What I've seen in my own practice is we almost use it like a sliding scale. So they're a little bit cooler than normal. We try to let them warm up. If they don't do well with that, we kind of take them back down. So you kind of just like play with the temperatures a little bit to see how the patient is doing.
And are there any related interventions to consider when treating a patient who is hypothermic?
There's a lot. It was one of the reasons that I always found these patients so fascinating is because they are so busy. But you want to make sure that you're monitoring all the different lab values. Potassium is extremely essential to monitor and replace as necessary. When a patient is hypothermic, they are almost certainly going to be hypokalemic. Not only do you lose potassium in the urine, but your body also shifts it into your cells. So that being said, when you are warming, you need to be very careful that you don't warm too quickly or overshoot and let the patient become hyperkalemic. So watch, you know, how you're replacing based on where you are in that warming process. Depending on the level of hypothermia, coags need to be monitored. Hypothermia changes both the clotting cascade and the function of the platelets. So you need to be careful of those. You are less sensitive to insulin when you're hypothermic. So generally see a lot more insulin being given in those cases, but we're more sensitive to sedatives and anesthetics. So watching that as well and not giving too much in that case. Excuse me. Bradycardia will happen. That's just a given. How much bradycardia and how they tolerate it is very temp and patient dependent. In general, though, the lower the temperature, the lower the bradycardia.
Okay. What are your thoughts on internal versus external cooling?
A little bit of a loaded question there, but I mean, they're both very effective. Internal does have some benefits as you are cooling from the inside out, cooling the blood directly. excuse me, there's potentially less shivering. Not that there's no shivering, but there's potentially less. Mm-hmm. External cooling, though, can be nurse-driven, nurse-started. There's no wait time. Yes, you're probably going to get some shivering, but that can be managed. You know, they're both very effective and it depends on your facility and what works best. There are some, downsides to internal cooling as well, especially if the patient is of size. As we know, adipose tissue is not well vascularized. So if you're cooling by cooling the blood, you're not going to cool their adipose tissue. So that could be an issue as well. Excuse me.
I'll let you get a sip of water while I ask the next question. are textbooks and the new generation NCLEX going to start using 98 degrees Fahrenheit as the new average adult temp?
what I've mostly seen about that is probably not. excuse me, because of gender, time of day, age, all of those can change your own temperature. The researchers don't advise at this time updating any of the standards.
How does temperature alteration affect mechanically ventilated patients? Are there any specific guidelines on temperature management for this population?
It's a good question. Depending on where you're headed with this question, there has been some research that suggests that temperature control can help reduce inflammation in other parts of the body besides the brain. So in the lungs, there's been a couple of studies looking at using TTM in ARDS patients, in ARDS patients. But I don't think anything really definitive. I think people are still kind of studying and researching that. I mean, it makes sense. As far as I've had questions prior about using an esophageal probe with a mechanically ventilated patient and if that changes that temperature, most of the time, no, that's not going to happen. So if that's where the question was headed, that's that answer as well.
Okay. Which is the best temperature checking method for newborns?
Esophageal is going to be your most accurate temp in any patient, regardless of age. That is what I see most commonly in newborns. You do see a little bit of rectal use, but not much. I think esophageal is generally what I see and is the most appropriate.
Okay.
It's the most core.
Okay, very good. So what is considered a normal temperature?
Well, like the previous question just asked, you know, it does appear that we're seeing a little bit of a downward trend in normal temps, but that's really why we continue to talk about them in a range. So the range of normal temperature is between like 36, sometimes you'll see 38, but 36 and 37, 8 is considered normal. I think the range is usually better.
If the patient comes into the ER already hypothermic, is the goal still to start start TTM within 1.5 hours of Roski?
You know, the ultimate goal is to have your patient at goal within 4 to 6 hours from Rosk. So whether that be you need to warm them up or you need to cool them down, if they're already hypothermic and you don't want them that hypothermic, you're already kind of considered at goal. Like if you have to warm back up, it's the bigger problem is if they come in hyperthermic and you need to get them down to a goal, that you definitely want to do within 4 to 6 hours. But if they're already hypothermic, you're kind of already there.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Looks like we have time for just one more question. At what temperature should a nurse notify a physician?
Oh, that really depends. If the patient is hypothermic, if the patient cannot be controlled or is symptomatic below 32, I would think the physician would be called as there may be some sort of neurological concern there. If the temp is above normal, again, it will depend on how the patient is responding and the reason for the temp above normal. If they're tolerating it, great. If they're not, and you know, in a, let's say a septic patient, if they're tolerating a little bit of a fever, we probably just let it go and, you know, not worry about it too much. But when it starts affecting their metabolism, meaning their heart rate's too high, blood pressure's being affected, those kind of things, then you would need to call somebody if you don't have already a protocol or orders in place for that. If it's a neurosurgical patient, you're probably, if you don't already have ways to manage that fever, you're probably going to have to get your physician involved to find out, because they definitely will not want them being hyperthermic in those situations. So it depends.
Well, thank you, Tammy. Thank you both, Tammy and Hannah, for your time and your expertise. And thank all of you for attending today. I just wanted to remind you that the webinar will be available on demand. You'll get a link to the webinar, but if you want to visit it, I mean, it should be up shortly at myamericannurse.com/webinars. You can find it there. It will include the Q&A portion, so you can revisit some of these questions and answers that Tammy and Hannah answered today. And thank you again, everybody, and have a great rest of your day.